Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 692, titled Women in the Klan, subtitled Palin by Comparison, Part 2. This program is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2009. And as we contemplate this year's harvest moon, tonight is a full moon, the harvest moon, usually coming a little later in October, but earlier this month. We're going to be taking a look at something of the political harvest that's being gathered in this country, and specifically taking a look at the phenomenon of the political ascendance of Sarah Palin, which I think in many ways is a sort of mystical nativist view of small-town womanhood that is very much allied with the very strong early 20th century female presence in the Ku Klux Klan. As I've noted a number of times in Side 1, there was a fundamental contradiction in the Klan's attitude toward women. On the one hand, it was explicitly patronizing and patriarchal and chauvinistic, and viewed women as of secondary importance, and yet at the same time, women were elevated to this sort of mystical and racial and social purity. They became symbols of some sort of white supremacist ideological purity. And there was a fundamental contradiction within the Klan vis-a-vis women's rights. I also want to stress that while none of what I'm saying should be misunderstood as, you know, the Rush Limbaugh style characterization of feminists as feminazis, at the same time, the incorporation into Klan ideology of some of the major features of women's ideology or feminist ideology at the time, chiefly attitude towards women's suffrage, women acquiring the vote, and some other similarities with traditional feminist ideology should alert us to the possibility that a political philosophy, a progressive political philosophy, however worthy and noble, can also at times and perhaps for some purposes be corrupted to a fascist or racist purpose under the circumstances. Turning once again to the book Women of the Klan by Kathleen Blay, of the growth of the Klan faction within the female faction within the Ku Klux Klan, and also of the women's Klan or WKKK's adoption of many features of what was then in the early 20th century feminist political ideology, we read: the KKK's views on white womanhood reflected these conflicting concerns and the tension between image and political reality within the Klan. The Ku Klux Klan catechism asked Klansmen, quote, "What is the attitude of the Klan toward women?" unquote, to which they were to reply, again quoting, "The Klan believes in the purity of womanhood and in the fullest measure of freedom compatible with the highest type of womanhood, including the suffrage," unquote. The KKK insisted that it advocated the political rights of white Protestant women, but it clung to white womanhood as a central symbol of white supremacy. In the words of the Bright Fiery Cross, a popular Klan hymn of the 1920s, sung at rallies and parades to the tune of Marching to Georgia, these concerns merged. Yes, and there were women folks who lined up with them too, for they felt there was some work that they would need to do. Since they have the right to vote, they'd help to put it through, and we go marching to victory. As the temperance and moral reform movements of the early 20th century did, the Klan saw women's inherently moral natures as key to campaigns for clean government and control of vice, since women would vote for candidates promising to rid the country of liquor, prostitution, and gambling. Without question, the KKK assured its members bringing white Protestant women into the electoral arena would result in less corrupt politics. Quote, "A woman has conviction and ideals, and she is willing to sacrifice party and her own political aspirations for the common good of the country and American ideals," unquote. Its endorsement, that is to say, the Klan's endorsement of women's suffrage and the expansion of women's legal rights, however, threatened to undermine other aspects of the Klan's agenda. A particular difficulty arose from the Klan's emphasis on Christianity as the vehicle for women's equality. In Klan doctrine, the spread of Christianity, especially Protestantism, elevated the status of women throughout the world. But the Klan also argued that in the United States, a nation founded on Protestant beliefs, women had only recently begun to assume the place in the world that was rightfully theirs. One way the Klan handled the apparent lag in gender equality in a Christian nation was to reinterpret U.S. history to emphasize women's hidden power. As the Imperial Nighthawk explained in an editorial, quote, "The American woman has had as much to do with the shaping of the destiny of America as the American man," unquote. Women operated through indirect channels, using their control over the home to exercise power in the outside world. As mothers and wives, women had a role in the world that was at least as influential as men's, even if their formal rights were limited. Another approach was to argue that both paid employment and Christianity were necessary for women to achieve full equality. Quote, "Women's economic freedom, according to the Klan press, which has slumbered for ages, awakes," unquote. With women in the workforce came a struggle, quote, "to balance and readjust sex, an entirely new conception of the meaning of sex and of the relation of men and women to each other is being born out of this struggle," unquote. Christianity was unable to liberate women while they languished in economic bondage to men. Only when women gained a measure of economic independence could the Christian message of gender equality be heard. Not everyone in the Second Klan, of course, had such a positive opinion of women's paid employment. A woman wrote the Courier magazine to explain that since women had entered the ranks of wage earners, they no longer gave proper attention to the rearing of children. The proper place for women with children, she insisted, was in the home, not in the workplace. Others in the Klan, however, scoffed at this, arguing that such ideas were the legacy of an earlier, less enlightened time. Quote, "No longer will man say that in the hand of woman rests the necessity of rocking a cradle only. She has within her hand the power to rule the world," unquote. By the way, all of these quotes are from Klan publications. Continuing, Klanswomen approached the question of women's status differently than their male counterparts did. While always asserting the centrality of home life to women and to the nation, the WKKK dissented from the idealized view of home and family that was such a powerful symbol in the men's Klan. Instead, Klanswomen described the home as a place of labor for women, the site of monotonous and grinding toil and sacrifice, unquote. The life of a homemaker, the WKKK insisted, was held in low esteem, unquote, by the larger society, and women received too little credit for their efforts in the home. It also pictured marriage as a double-edged sword for women, at once women's crowning glory and the burden they bore. One Klanswoman commented, "Marriage had always presented problems to American women," quote, and by the way, aside from the Klan's racist ideology, I kind of got a kick out of the phrase that follows here. Quote, and again, this is a direct quote from a Klanswoman. "Pilgrim mothers not only endured the hardships of the pilgrim fathers, but what was a greater burden, they had to endure the pilgrim fathers themselves," unquote. Even motherhood, whether the mothering of children or the nurturance of a nation, the WKKK described as women's work, unquote. While men portrayed child-rearing as women's glorious mission, unquote, Klanswomen called it women's burden, unquote. A massive WKKK celebration of Mother's Day addressed this issue of motherhood, quote, "Throwing off her hood to reveal a modish bob and employing a brogue, the leader of the feminine hosts in the realm of New Jersey cried, quote, 'I'm here to speak today with all these girls present because the girls of today are the mothers of tomorrow. When you see a lady that acts a little peculiar, don't ridicule her. Just remember, she's somebody's mother, and she's working 24 hours a day while you're only working 8, unquote. Some women's Klan leaders proposed actions that Klanswomen could take to change their predicament. One Klegel encouraged Klanswomen mothers to campaign collectively for an 8-hour day for the job of mothering. Currently, she argued, women were forced to shoulder a 24-hour responsibility while men were required to work only one-third as much time. The ultimate solution for Klanswomen lay in political action. By safeguarding the privileges of all white Protestants, the WKKK insisted, white Protestant women would gain better working conditions in the home and more recognition of their contributions as wives and mothers as well. Like most Klan propaganda, however, the argument provided no further details. Klanswomen also framed their support of white Protestant women's political and legal rights in different terms than Klansmen did. The men's position was instrumental, intended to augment the political muscle of white Protestant men with a cadre of enfranchised female followers. The WKKK, however, insisted that women needed the vote for two reasons: to maintain a moral white Protestant nation and also to ensure women's rights. Even while shouldering onerous family responsibilities, women kept the, quote, spiritual fire of the nation burning, unquote, and acted as the conscience keeper of the race, unquote. Women's efforts inspired every moral law, every law regarding sanitation, prison reform, child labor, and control of liquor, unquote. Klanswomen worried that men's support for women's rights would wane over time and urged women to hold fast, unquote, to the franchise, i.e. the vote, and push for additional guarantees of equal treatment with men. The speeches of WKKK Imperial Commander Robbie Gill show the development of the WKKK's position on gender equality. By the way, if people have just tuned in, WKKK is the Women's Ku Klux Klan. Continuing. Soon after taking office in 1924, Ms. Gill addressed a KKK convocation on American women, unquote, an address frequently reprinted in the Klan press. Gill appropriated the Christian emphasis of the Klan and used it to support an agenda of women's rights. Quote, "It has never been the purpose of God," she declared, "that women should be the slave of man," unquote, or "that woman should be the slave of man," unquote. Women's subordination was the legacy of primitive, unquote, theologies. In a Protestant nation, women, i.e. white Protestant women, were entitled to education, refinement, and honor, unquote. Gill's analysis of women in politics differs significantly from Klansmen's use of images of helpless white Protestant women to incite racial and nationalistic hatred. Until women gained the vote, Gill argued, they were forced to exercise power by influencing men. The greatest strength of women's power lies in the way in which men depend upon her and are, for the most part, absolutely or nearly so helpless without her, unquote. In the 20th century, the situation changed. Women's enfranchisement gave them power that was direct and independent of the power of men. Moreover, women's numerical superiority in the population meant that women held the balance of electoral power. To Robbie Gill, it was not implausible that white Protestant women might be persuaded to vote as a bloc, since women's vulnerability to the excesses of men gave them interests in common. Quote, "She knows who will suffer most if her husband or son or brother or sweetheart becomes a drunkard or a drug addict, if gambling grips the life of her loved one, if some silly, irresponsible affinity," unquote, "breaks up her home," unquote. By the way, the sanctity of the home life from extramarital affairs, booze, drugs, what have you, and the linking of these various vices to immigrants, people of color, Negroes, unquote, in particular, Jews and Catholics, was a major element of the Klan view of the necessity for social purity. And indeed, the advocacy engaged in by Klan's women was part of this call for a purification of society through the exclusion and suppression of those other unclean elements. And by the way, as we're going to see, the support the women's Klan generated a lot of support for temperance, for the banning of alcoholic beverages. And again, the destructive effect of drunkenness and alcoholism on the family unit, and women in particular, was a major element of that viewpoint. Continuing with Kathleen Blaze, Women of the Klan, "The right to vote would not make individual women less vulnerable to irresponsible or dissolute husbands," Klan leader Gill conceded, "but a unified effort by women could eliminate the vices that led men astray." Gill dismissed the concern raised by anti-suffragists as well as some Klansmen that female suffrage would create dissension if husbands and wives held different political views. It was important, Gill argued, that men recognize women as their political comrades, not their political followers. Gill set the terms of a new gender bargain. Women would maintain the home as a sanctuary for men, raise men's children, and assist them in business, but in turn expected both political rights and respect. 2 years later, the heady optimisms of Gill's first address was gone. Women's suffrage was 6 years old, but the expected political transformation had not come about. Many women did not vote at all, and those who did often voted as their husbands did. More disturbing to Gil Comer, now married, the WKKK had not been able to organize women into a voting bloc. Women did not necessarily cast their political weight behind Klan candidates or even behind candidates supporting temperance or opposing vice. Cleavages of social class, race, and region split women's electoral strength just as it did men's. For Gil Comer, the challenge in 1926 was to justify the need for a women's Klan and the importance of the Klan's attention to women's issues in light of the disappointing record of the female electorate. As she often did, Gil Comer turned to history for explanation and prediction. Through a woman's eyes, Gil Comer argued, all world history was characterized by cycles of advance and retreat on women's rights, advance coinciding with Protestantism and retreat with alien and savage doctrines. Early prehistory, what Gil Comer called the period of savagery, was a time when women, quote, sat back outside the circle of their masculine superiors and took the lesser pieces, unquote. A woman's responsibility in savage times was great as keeper of the fire, but she could expect only cruel revenge if she failed and no acknowledgement if she succeeded. When the time of savagery gave way to one of barbarism, women's work, although not their status, changed. A woman was responsible for hewing wood and drawing water, but remained to men nothing but a slave, a chattel, a beast of burden, unquote. A third historical stage in Western civilization, the stage of chivalry, brought a slight elevation of women's status to a pedestal of reverence and respect, unquote, but women continued to be subordinate to men. In Gil Comer's chronology, the turning point for women came with the Christian settlement of America. Early in the Christian history of the new nation, women still lacked legal and political rights, a legacy of chivalry, which exalted women but kept them from learning the serious responsibilities, unquote, that were necessary for ruling the country. And then, quoting Gil, "How could we be expected to know the intricacies of politics when we had never been trained to understand them? If women do not stand together where they should, does not the explanation lie somewhat in the fact that until yesterday she was allowed to have no interests save petty ones?" Unquote. By the 20th century, however, white Protestant women had attained political rights and were on their way to gaining economic and social rights as well. Men in the Klan, Gil Comer counseled, should not be discouraged that women lacked political savvy to recognize and act on the interests of white Protestant Americans. Women needed additional time and training to complete their political education. The Klan movement would eventually benefit if it continued to cultivate its female constituency. Gil Comer's next printed address in 1928 noted that women had enjoyed equality of opportunity for only a century and the franchise for less than a decade. Again, she defended women against the charge of political ineptitude, saying, quote, "Some men speak sneeringly of the fact that we have not yet learned how to use it any better than they, when the remarkable thing is that we are using it as well," unquote. In previous speeches, Gil Comer credited enlightened men with giving women the opportunity to advance. By 1928, however, Gil Comer shifted credit for increases in women's status from men's largesse to the impersonal advance of technology and economic development. Time-saving inventions for the household, she argued, released women from the slavery of many kinds of household drudgery, and the automobile lessened the isolation of many women, especially those in rural areas. Women were now freed to pursue the social, political, and intellectual concerns that men's lives had always allowed. Women had the time and the means to meet other women, exchange information, and ponder mutual concerns. Moreover, increasing employment opportunities for women meant that they were no longer dependent on the economic beneficence of men. Casting in positive terms an outcome deeply feared by men, Gil Comer declared, quote, "Woman does not now have to accept the first man who asks her hand in marriage. She may choose her time for marriage, or if she wishes, she may choose not to marry at all and endure no reproach from the world," unquote. Gil Comer spoke of the need for women to have equal power with men in marriage, to be free to stay unmarried, and to be treated as equals in political and economic life. Drawing on her personal experiences, Gil Comer even spoke of tensions in her role as head of the women's Klan. "Man, by habit, speaks his mind freely on greater questions. Woman often hesitates to do so. I feel my limitations, I believe, far more than could any man of equivalent position and experience. I hesitate to say the things that are in my heart, lest I may not be taken seriously, lest I may be misunderstood by men and women alike. It is my heritage as a woman." Unquote. Gil Comer's support for women's rights did not preclude supporting gender inequality when it would benefit women. Like leaders of women's labor unions and consumer leagues at the time, Gil Comer argued that women needed to hold fast to existing doctrines that granted special protection to women, even if these were based on antiquated notions of gender inequality. Taking pains to separate herself and the women's clan from feminist, quote, extremists, unquote, Gil Comer insisted that women should have special safeguards in industry to compensate for their physical limitations and to allow them to compete economically with men, and that they should be excluded from the military. Although she now supported white Protestant women's rights, Gil Comer maintained a strict view of women's and men's separate responsibilities for both the home and the family. Her analysis of the causes for society's moral decay is a case in point. Men contributed to moral decline with their drinking, gambling, and sexual exploits, actions that lined the pockets of the purveyors of vice and set a bad example for future generations of men. Quote, "What boy may be reproved for intemperance when he steals his whiskey or gin from his father's own illegal pocket flask?" Unquote. Women were assessed blame for a different kind of action. Women contributed to moral decline when their paid employment made them unavailable to monitor their delinquent children. Men erred by actions of vice. Women erred by departure from their traditional roles. What daughter may be reproved for remaining with wild companions into the late hours away from home when it is a home to which her mother returns only during the day to change her clothes and late at night to sleep? Unquote. In 1929, the Klan's imminent collapse did not preclude a positive note in Gil Comer's address. Answering male critics of women's suffrage, she noted that her faith in women had been vindicated by the decisive influence of women's organizations in the defeat of Catholic, anti-prohibition presidential candidate Al Smith. Smith's mistake was to, quote, underestimate the clout of organized women, unquote. Again, quoting, "Smith ought to have remembered that cradles have gone out of style and that the hands which once rocked them are now free to cast ballots for decent candidates," unquote. The WKKK, Gil Comer boasted, swayed women against voting for Smith whether or not they were members of the Klan. The women's Klan had awakened the conscience, unquote, of women and educated them about their responsibilities to endure the strength of Protestantism and Americanism, resulting in a large turnout of women in the polls to vote against Smith. By the way, Al Smith was the first Catholic presidential candidate before John F. Kennedy became the first successful Catholic presidential candidate. Continuing, of Klan women's leader Robbie Gil Comer. Gil Comer gave a final convocation speech in 1930 when both the women's and the men's clans were disintegrating. In this address, she reflected on the history of her women's order and summed up its accomplishments and weaknesses. The WKKK, she argued, had succeeded in its mission to provide political education to white Protestant American women. The troubles of the Klan movement need not interfere with the political momentum that white Protestant women had achieved, yet much of the political agenda of the women's Klan remained undone. Women should continue to fight for their rights as whites, as native-born Americans, as Protestant Christians, and especially as women. Gil Comer concluded with a poetic admonition to her female followers, quote, "Be strong. We are not here to play, to dream, to drift. We have hard work to do and loads to lift. Shun not the struggle, face it. 'Tis God's gift. Be strong. Say not the days are evil. Who's to blame? And fold the hands and acquiesce. Oh, shame. Stand up, speak out, and bravely in God's name. Be strong. It matters not how deep entrenched the wrong, how hard the battle goes, the day how long. Faint not, fight on, tomorrow comes the sun." The contradictions and ambiguities of gender ideology were never resolved within the women's KKK, just as they remain unresolved within the men's Klan. Gil Comer and her Klanswomen, many attracted to the women's Klan because it supported women's rights, along with white and Protestant supremacy, continued to press for women's equality in society, if not within the invisible empire itself, even when support for women's rights fit uneasily with traditional Klan beliefs in Christian progress and female helplessness. Yet they were not willing to endorse any political agenda that seemed to link them with feminist, quote, extremists, unquote. The Klan principles of white Protestant family life and the creation of the women's Klan by and within the earlier men's Klan tempered Klanswomen's full endorsement of women's equality. Klanswomen sought rights in politics, the economy, marriage, and the law, but they stopped far short of supporting full equality between white Protestant women and men. And in the last couple of minutes here, we're going to take a look at the role within the Klan of a woman named Daisy Barr. She was a Klanswoman who previously had been tapped to head up a Klan front organization, or basically a Klan women's organization, called the Queens of the Golden Mask. And of Daisy Barr and her support for the contemporary feminism of the time. First of all, let's read about Daisy Barr and her appointment as head of the QGM, or Queens of the Golden Mask. Stevenson brought Barr into the Klan as head of the Queens of the Golden Mask, or QGM, a female counterpart of his Indiana KKK. Insisting on tight control of her organization, Barr hired field representatives to travel to Indiana to recruit for the QGM. And of Barr's support for the women's movement of the time, Barr advocated rights, both as evangelist and political organizer. Barr emphasized the effects of all social vices on the lives of women. Of special concern were the temptations faced by young working girls in the city, loneliness, poverty, and contact with unsavory elements in factory life, Barr warned, lured young women into a life of prostitution. To combat these temptations, Barr organized a Young Women's Christian Association, or YWCA, in Muncie, Indiana, to supplement the branch of the YMCA established earlier by the local elite. Barr advocated rights as well as protection for women. She used her fame as an evangelist to encourage advocates of women's equality to join the church. One sermon told of a woman who was interested in women's progress and who was brought back to spiritual faith when she entered Barr's tabernacle to support the female ministry. Barr was adamant in her call for the admission of women to the ministry as well. In an article in the widely circulated Indianapolis News, she was insistent, quote, "One can hardly imagine under our present-day progress that most of the religious denominations in our own country still refuse the right of ordination to women applicants. Women have entered the professions of law, medicine, teaching, art, music, and even are wrestling with the sciences, and yet the relic of our barbarism and heathenism dogmas, when the belief was current that women had no souls, is still evident in the fact that other doors are open while the holy ministry still bars her from free entrance." When local newspapers in Muncie agreed to reprint her sermons, Daisy's political fortunes soared. The combination of pulpit and newspaper gave Barr a powerful forum for her views, which included denunciation of the Sunday retail trade, opposition to the sexual double standard, and a diatribe against church members who used racial slurs. I would also note that eventually she became an unqualified Klanswoman. But again, note her support for traditional values, or for values that have traditionally become incorporated into a contemporary feminist agenda. Again, the situation vis-a-vis women of the Klan was one of fundamental contradiction. So too, however, I think we need to be aware of the potential for any progressive movement to be seduced, at least in part, by a fascist political movement that is willing to adopt parts of its agenda in order to co-opt it. Not the best of grammar, but you can't win them all, folks. That concludes For the Record Program 692, Side 2, Women in the Klan, subtitled Palin by Comparison, Part 2. This has been recorded on October 4th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.